This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen to it.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I want to begin by introducing you to the new book we have from Moonrock Books, And Nobody Died in Boston Either. You can see the front and the back cover in the first slide, and where on the back we find terrorism, state-sponsored terrorism with Hollywood special effects. There was noise and smoke, but there was no blood, which is a physiological impossibility. The blood only started showing up later, and it was fake blood, Hollywood blood, and the smoke came out of a machine. According to the FBI report and the indictment for Zokir Saranov, the bombs that exploded were in black nylon backpacks. But neither Tamerlan nor Zokir were wearing black nylon backpacks. A retired professor of law, John Remington Graham, has observed, "This means there was not even probable cause for an arrest or an indictment, much less a conviction at trial. Only Russia today got it right." And if you look at those images, on the left is actually a photograph of the smoke machine, which was discovered by Alan William Powell, who, as in the case of the Sandy Hook book, has two chapters here. And on the right, you see the images from Russia today, where I'm going to go through each of the elements here to demonstrate that what we have at the Boston bombing may be the most amateurish false flag of them all. And I'm very pleased to see that Gary King has joined us. And Gary, I know you were just dumbfounded at the amateurishness of the Boston bombing right from scratch.
I've always said that this is the one that even the most hardwired people through social engineering can figure out. Now, hold on. We're not talking about the free fall rate time X squared. We're talking about a guy who has 9 fingers one day, and 17 days later, he's got 10. That's my kind of evidence. I leave the heavy stuff to you.
Well, Gary, I think that's very astute. Yeah, and we're talking about this Jeff Bauman fellow, both before and after he had presumably been receiving medical treatment. We'll get to it and talk about it more. Let's go to the second slide, Chance. Now, the reason I want to zoom in here, as you see, from a video that was taken during the time of the marathon bombing, in the background, you can see a voice on a bullhorn calling out, "This is a drill. This is a drill." Gary, I mean, they're telling us what they're doing. How can anyone miss the point?
There are countless witnesses who said there was people running around with bullhorns saying, "It's a drill." And believe it or not, you know, the orange signs, they say, road construction in progress or bridge construction. Well, this one said, I think it was mass casualty drill in progress.
I love it, Gary. I love it.
It was on the sign. Now, I don't want to jump the gun, but let's not forget about tweeting the day before that there will be 2 explosions tomorrow at the Boston Marathon finish.
Well, actually, in slide number 3, we have the 2 tweets from the Boston Globe. There may well have been more. But one says, "Breaking news, police will have controlled explosion on 600 block on Boylston Street," in the first on the left. And then on the right, "Official, there will be a controlled explosion opposite the library within 1 minute as part of bomb squad activities." And lo and behold, Gary, Within 1 minute, there was an explosion opposite the Boston Public Library. Do you think the Boston Globe knew what was going on?
Man, isn't that the one, Jim? I mean, isn't that the one that cannot be disputed? I remember showing Russ Baker that. He couldn't believe it. So we look, if this is the litmus test, and I've gotten in front of many a shill and tell them that the Boston Marathon is the most embarrassing, laughable hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. And if you think that having 9 fingers 1 week and having 10, how about your leg falling off in the street and putting it back on? Now, come on.
We'll get to that, Gary. We'll get to that.
I'm sorry, Jim. I get worked up on the Boston Marathon now.
Well, what I'm hoping, Gary, is that for those who found Sandy Hook so emotionally traumatizing in the false belief that 20 children had been killed, I'm hopeful that if they see through one of these scams, where the Boston bombing seems to be the most obvious, they can come back.
This is the one.
A mind ajar, no longer dominated by emotions, where they're actually able to reason about what happened at Sandy Hook.
Yeah, I mean, what can you say when you show someone a picture of a guy with kneecaps, and then the next thing you know, he's amputated up to his butt? I mean, it's just nuts.
You're right on top of this, Gary. I love it. Let's look at the next slide, which actually shows the honest-to-God perps. These were Kraft International personnel. Look at them on the right with khaki trousers, dark jackets. They have a black baseball cap with a skull insignia. Their motto, Gary, is violence does solve problems. And look at the guys on the left. They have these black nylon backpacks. And notice in particular the white square on the one, on the fellow on the left. The blue line is to a fellow in his black cap with a skull insignia. And the other is a fellow who is carrying the black nylon backpack with a square on it, which is particularly important in relation to the next slide, because it turns out that the bomb that exploded on the right just happened to be a black nylon backpack with a white square, Gary. And in the upper left, we have this Kraft International guy wearing a black nylon backpack with a white square. And then after he puts down the bomb, he's running away and he's no longer wearing his backpack, Gary. Is this a tough challenge here?
It looks like a backpack convention over here. Is this like a runway for backpacks, you know, and khakis? This is the khaki backpack commercial filming, I guess.
Gary, actually, I think a 7-year-old could figure this one out. Am I wrong?
I will continue to say this is the one for the most asleep. If you can't wake up to this one, then you're too hardwired. And there are people that way. I'm afraid to say that you cannot crack them. But if this doesn't do it, then there is no hope.
Well, it's truly fascinating. Take a look at the next slide then, which is the real clincher, because now understand that both the FBI report on the Boston Marathon bombing and the indictment for Zucker in the courthouse said that the bombs that exploded were black nylon backpacks. Now, there you have the two brothers, Gary. One in the foreground is Zucker, and in the background you have Tamerlan. Does either of those backpacks look like a black nylon backpack?
Wait, I got my 5-year-old in the next room. Let me go get her.
Well, look how Zucker's is gray or silver.
It's one's black, one's white. I mean, come on. It's not even gray or black or white or gray. It's black and white. I mean, I'm sorry.
No, Gary, I want to have your reaction. Yeah. I mean, so how can these guys have been the perps when they don't have the backpacks that match? That was the opinion of a former professor of law, John Remington Graham, Gary, that if the backpacks don't match, then there was no probable cause for an arrest or an indictment, much less a conviction. I'm reminded of the OJ case. If the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. Except those were snug-fitting gloves, and the defense very cleverly had him put on latex gloves underneath them, which guaranteed they wouldn't fit.
This backpack would be instant acquittal in any courtroom, kangaroo or not. I mean, you can't hide this kind of evidence. And I know you followed the trial much more than I did. I mean, how did they cover up all this evidence? Was it a closed-door trial or was it a fake trial?
Well, we'll get to it. But in fact, Judy Clark, who is a defense attorney, although she had formally pled Zocher not guilty during her opening statement, Gary, she said they did it. During her opening statement, she said they did it.
Wow, man. Please do not recommend this attorney if ever I get in trouble.
You know? Gary, it's unbelievable. This was a slam dunk case for proof of innocence because neither of the brothers had anything to do with it. But she made sure that the jury would find him guilty after his brother was killed purportedly by Zocher himself, which we'll discover is simply absurd. Once you understand the sequence of events, let's take a look at the next slide. Now, Gary, you notice there's a lot of smoke, and there definitely are people there that have missing body parts. But what do you notice isn't present that ought to be present?
Well, there's a black lady there with a guy's leg with no foot on it on top of her head. And she doesn't have any blood on her face or her shirt or anything else is one thing that I see.
Well, you got the right idea, Gary, because there's smoke and there are bodies with missing parts, but there is no blood. Well, Lorraine Day, MD, was chief of orthopedic surgery at San Francisco General Hospital for 25 years, has observed that this would be a physiological impossibility if this had been a real event. There would have instantaneously been blood everywhere. But there's no blood there, Gary.
Yeah, but I bet you there's a picture of someone pulling some out of their coat or something like that.
Well, actually, Alan found some photos showing tubes, that the blood seems to have come out of tubes, and it was Hollywood blood. But this is particularly important images because you notice on the very left, there's a man in a hoodie working on this fellow who's supposed to be Jeff Bauman, and he's actually attaching a false prosthesis with a bone extension, Gary, to make the event look even more horrifying.
Right. That will fall off later on, and they'll have to stick it back on.
I know. Yeah, Gary, this is just dumbfounding. You know how anyone could take this seriously.
I'm still talking about the guy with no foot on top of the lady's head with no blood.
Yeah, I love it, Gary. Let's look at the next. Same scene, but different point. According to reports from the Associated Press, such as the Huffington Post on 23 April 2013, three persons, including one child, were killed and 260 were injured. It has become part of the official narrative about the Boston event, but the images from the scene suggest a number closer to 20. Where are the other 240 victims, Gary?
I don't know, but hold on. Take a good look to the left, center of the left picture, and look at the, you can finally see what I was talking about. The guy's leg with no foot is on top of the black lady's head, and then she has, looks like a bib almost, or a white shirt. And there's no blood going on. And this dude lost his foot and his foot's on top of her head and there's no blood.
Oh, didn't you know, Gary, people lose their limbs all the time with no blood. I mean, this is just so ridiculous. It's beyond belief.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I sometimes you just can't. I mean, look, can anybody see that leg on top of that lady's head? You know,
I'm looking to see the one you mean, Gary.
There's two pictures, the one on the left.
Yes.
Right there in the center, there's Bauman with his double gray shirt. And then you see his leg sticking up. He's on his back.
Right.
And then you see his leg and his knee. And then his foot with no, wait, his leg or that's with no foot is on top of her head.
That's the fake bone extension the guy in the foot in the hoodie had just attached, Gary.
But it's on top of the lady's head.
I know. And there is no blood. You're absolutely right.
Look, she's got a bib. There should be some sort of blood if she's got like a white. I think it's a white shirt, but it looks like a bib from here, like a baby's bib.
That's a nice point, Gary, that if there were blood, it would be showing up. It would be very colorful.
Maybe some in her hair, maybe?
Maybe some in her hair. But there's none there. Look at the next image and you see what's conspicuously missing from those we've been looking at. Look at all that stuff, Gary.
It looks like some red paint for my kid's wagon.
Well, you're right on top of it because that's Hollywood blood, and it does stay bright red. It's orangish red. It doesn't change color. Real blood, which you can see in the insert there, which came from a bombing in Cairo, actually turns dark red because it loses its oxygen content, so it deoxygenates. But this Hollywood blood remains bright red permanently. It never changes. Something, Gary?
These are not deep, dark secrets that blood turns a different color when it gets, when air hits it. And then look at Obama laying there with his foot completely gone. Oh, my God.
I know.
And what are we going to do? We're going to put him in a wheelchair and roll him around.
He ought to be massively bleeding out, Gary.
With
that kind of injury, you'd be unconscious in 1 minute, dead in two. But he doesn't even seem to be in particular agony.
He's looking at the ground right now, rolling around, waiting for somebody to pick him up. And here's the best part, Jim. The lady that his foot was on top of, who is not injured, she gets on a stretcher first. Before him. Now,
that's her in the background, huh?
Yes, they put her on the stretcher before him. Now, if anybody needs to be on a stretcher, it's this guy if your leg is really gone like that.
That's right. And you're supposed to be kept horizontal if you, in fact, have an injury of this kind to keep that, so that gravity doesn't help the blood to bleed out.
The last thing you're going to do is put someone in a wheelchair and roll him around.
I know, Gary. It's absolutely unbelievable. But that's what they do here. They put him in a wheelchair. Look at the next image, number 11. This is Nathan Foulkes on the left, Gary. He's a Hollywood producer, director. Next slide, Gary. Chance. Oh, wait. No, I see. I was one. You're right. I was wrong. This is a woman who claims to have had both her tibia and her fibula on both legs broken and her Achilles tendon severed. And look, does she look like she's in pain, Gary?
Looks like she's watching a tennis match.
But look at the images, the inserts are professional athletes who had more minor versions of these injuries, and they're grimacing in pain. But she looks pretty comfortable, don't you think?
Well, the other guy lost his whole leg. He's smiling. Everything's fine.
I mean, Gary, it's ridiculous beyond belief.
It's the number one of all time. It's the one. If you're going to wake anyone up, this has got to be it. You don't have 26 dead children where you have to tug with your heart. It's just different this time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And yet the country swallowed it hook, line, and sinker.
I didn't want to get into the websites that are donating money to people that didn't get hurt. I mean, that's got to be the sin of all the sins involved in this evil, is that they would actually have websites for people that didn't die and take money from people. And to do with it, God only knows.
Well, certainly embarrassing, and we're picking out just some of the highlights here. Let's go to the next slide.
Here's the champion of all time.
That's right. There's Jeff Bauman on the right with his fake bone extension, and as you observe, the vibrations of moving him in the wheelchair were so substantial it caused the prosthesis to fall off, and they had to stop and reattach it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to say one thing here. This is another slam dunk smoking gun. Let's look at the guy in the cowboy hat. Now, you've just lost both legs. You only have one tourniquet, and there's a dude in a cowboy hat with pinching one vein as if holding that one vein is going to do anything at a time like this. Look at that.
Good. And in addition, Gary, the tourniquet is so loose that it's not actually functioning to shut off the flow of blood.
The only way to survive is if you have two hardcore tourniquets within 1 minute. That's the only chance to survive. I've talked to too many doctors. I teach music. I teach probably six or seven doctors, and every one of them I've shown this picture. And I ask them, what happens when you lose both legs? And they say three things. You turn white, you puke, and you pass out. And if you're lucky, two people are going to put a tourniquet on both of these major arteries within 1 minute, or you will die. It's as simple as that. Just medically, you say you like the medical evidence, right? Well, here it is.
Gary, this fellow Jeff Bowman is a medical miracle. They're going to put him in the books to be studied at the medical school.
Now he's going to be at the Boston Bruins hockey game partying down in just 2 weeks.
Well, you're right. That's coming up.
Everything's fine. Don't worry about it. Never mind the 100 operations necessary to recover from something like this. Never mind. We'll be at the hockey game waving flags in the middle of the rink.
Now, Gary, this fellow in the lime green vest, he was performing duty to help manage, you know, the scene. They didn't allow any emergency medical technicians. They didn't allow any ambulances. Would you believe they even stopped two priests who wanted to come and administer last rites?
That's the guy that put his leg back on. When it fell on the street, he's the one that put it back on.
Gary, it's just shocking. It's so blatant.
I know. Man, if I lose both my legs, please give me somebody better than a cowboy hat and holding one vein with his thumb. Like this. Where's my camera? He's holding one vein like that. And you're sitting here, lost. Think about it now. Both of your legs have been blown off. The agony, the pain. I mean, I remember smashing one of my fingers with a sledgehammer. I almost passed out from that. You know, I mean, you cannot not just pass out. And this guy's smiling. Okay, here comes the next picture. Here's our 10-finger guy.
Hang on a minute, Gary. The fellow on the left is a Hollywood producer and director. His name is Nathan Foulkes.
I don't know about this guy.
Well, he identified the man in the cowboy hat right alongside of Jeff Bauman as an actor and cast in one of his films. The film was entitled The Prosecution of an American President. It was based on a book by Vince Bugliosi, the L.A. prosecutor of Charles Manson, who authored Helter Skelter, the best-selling true crime book of all time. And his name is Carlos Arredondo.
Vince Bugliosi's in the middle of this? Man.
No. Vince Bugliosi was a book by Vince Bugliosi about the prosecution of George W. Bush for war crimes in relation to 9/11 was the foundation for the film in which Nathan Foulkes, the director on the left, cast the man in the cowboy hat as an actor.
Yeah, he's been in several things. And what I've gathered from this cowboy hat guy is that he got in major, major trouble with the government to where they had SWAT teams, they had helicopters, and somehow he was compromised, and he would do whatever he had to do, if I remember. I can't remember the details now. It's been a while since I've been, you know, researching the Boston Marathon, but he was in deep, and it seems a lot of these people are in deep trouble, and they will more than be happy to trade some sort of sentence for a role in a crisis acting job.
Gary, would you agree with me that one of the reasons they're conducting this massive surveillance is that so they can get something on everyone, so they can manipulate them and control them if they desire to do that?
Oh, it's just widespread as you can believe. Now, look, Mardi Gras just ended yesterday. They told us that every single security agency was in town. The CIA, the FBI, the National Security Administration, they had cameras. They said publicly that if you are in New Orleans, there's a camera on you, and parade route or not. Okay, now, they had a shooting at the end of one of the parades. Well, did they really? Well, then why didn't you catch them? Because you had all the surveillance, you had all the people, but why didn't you catch the people? So what they do, they put out another fake story, just like this is a fake story, that there was a shooting at the parade. There's always been a shooting at the parades, but I've never seen it. You see what I'm saying? So all it takes, and then my question is, well, my God, everybody, you had stuff flying, you had drones, you had all this stuff, but we didn't catch the people that shot at the end of the Rex parade. It just kills me, Jim.
Gary, it's really starting to bother.
More and more security. More and more security.
Right. And of course, you're right there in New Orleans where all this was taking place. Nathan said they were using a technique known as hyper-realistic filming to try to create scenes as realistic as possible. For example, to introduce inexperienced troops to what they'll encounter in combat. And they've even designed some special kinds of suit, Gary, that if you cut it, it will seem to bleed. Or if you rip it open, it looks like it's flesh. It's like a fake body.
Well, to me, this is actually an honorable job. This guy, Jeffrey Bauman, he doesn't know what's about to happen. And this guy lost his legs in Afghanistan or Iraq. And he has a sense of self-worth to help paramedics or people in combat to where if there is a bad accident on the interstate, that your help doesn't actually get lightheaded and throw up and pass out. So he has a sense of self-worth, but they've exploited this. You see the evil, the depth of the evil of these false flags. And all I can say is they didn't really do that good of a job. It wasn't really all that hyper realistic to me. In fact, it was pathetic. And all I can say is if you can't get a good acting job, well, then the crisis acting profession is paying pretty damn good. And you don't really have to be worth a crap at acting.
And as you know, we even found the Craigslist ad for extras out in San Bernardino saying it would be good pay, there'd be transportation, they'd be fed, and there'd be some speaking roles, Gary. The call was on December 1st, going live on the 2nd. I can't believe how open they are. It's absolutely shameless.
And they all have their IDs on there, and you can look up the IDs of FEMA, and you can tell which ones is which. This is a person that's acting with no trauma. It's just crazy. And then, like you say, it's on Craigslist ad. And see, that's what's going on here is that many of these people have probably participated in these drills maybe 30, 40 times. It's a good paying job, but they don't know that this one is going to go live. And the first question that is always asked of me, how do they get that many people involved and get away with it? Well, that's the simplest answer of all. What you do, you have a drill in place. Everything's ready to go. And what's the drill about? Well, about someone setting off a bomb at the Boston Marathon finish line. But what they're told is that someone infiltrated their drill and set off a real bomb. And suddenly they run to the television and they find out what happened from there. And there's also another element that they may be somewhat responsible for letting the guy in or somewhere, something didn't go right. So there's also that. And plus they've signed their lives away. You cannot talk about especially the real crisis actors. They're not allowed to talk to anyone, so it's easy as rain to make it look like there's only a few people that know about this. And even the people that are involved have been tricked by saying that someone set off a real bomb. Do you see it? See how easy it is?
It's embarrassing, Gary. It's so shameless. Let's look at the next slide, number 12.
Here's the champion again.
Now, there you see him where he has lost his legs below the knee, and yet just 19 days later, when ostensibly the same person, though as I look at them, I think this is actually another actor, Gary. Now he's lost his legs above the knee. I had several conversations with Dr. Stan Monteith, who is himself an orthopedic surgeon who had performed amputations like this. And he told me it took 3 to 6 months just to recover from the amputation, and another 3 to 6 months to learn how to get along without your legs. And yet 19 days later, here he is, cheerful as can be. at the Boston Bruins game. He looks pretty happy and content to me, Gary.
Hey, don't forget to count the fingers. He's holding up 10 fingers, and I'm sure the picture will come up pretty soon where he's got 9. But here's what I have to say, Jim. Imagine you're one of these schmucks that have to put this together. So they come up to you and they say, look, Jeffrey Bauman quit after the first day, so he's out of here. So we've got a job for you. And the guy goes, well, what is it? Well, we need you to find someone like that looks just like Jeffrey Bauman. Well, that might not be too hard, but a double amputee, now come on, that's a little difficult, isn't it? So you're not going to get someone exactly who's also a double amputee. It's common sense.
Yeah, and so in this case, the guy that showed up 19 days later had his legs lost above the knee, whereas Bauman had his legs lost below the knee. It led Dr. Stan to conclude, when I explained how they'd attach that false prosthesis to make it look more horrifying, that he thought this young man must be an actor.
Well, looks like he nailed it, right? Didn't Dr. Stan pass away?
Yep, he's gone.
Well, great observation before he went on, because that observation is going to live in infamy.
Well, he was an honest guy, Gary, and it turns out there aren't a whole lot out there. Let's look at this next. This next is really a shocker. This is the slide number 13. The alternative media, Gary, was so good with the Boston bombing that they had identified the Kraft International personnel as the real perps already the evening of the event. And Obama that day, when he came out, because Congress had not passed the gun control legislation he wanted, he was very ticked off about that. He said almost nothing about the Boston bombing. He was so preoccupied that Congress hadn't passed his gun control legislation. Well, because the alternative media had done such a great job, 4 days later, the FBI sent out this stooge to say, don't look at any of those photographs, only look at these two. And he put out a photograph of Tamerlan and of Zocher Serenev and asked for the public's assistance in identifying them, Gary.
How do guilty people behave? This is how guilty people behave.
Well, would you believe, Gary, it then turned out they'd had the brothers under surveillance for at least 5 years?
Can you spell Patsy here? It's just insane.
It's completely absurd. Let's look at the next slide. I mean, this was a man coming out and saying, don't look at the man behind the curtain, Gary, the FBI stooge. Now, here's a photograph of the two brothers, but they appear to have been selected as patsies because of their country of origin, but they were actually ordinary young men. Tamerlan had a wife and a child. He was thinking of moving to New York to pursue his career. Zocher was a college student, very popular, participating in wrestling. He went there after the bombing. But would you believe, this photograph led Marette Saraneva, who was their aunt, to explain to me that this footage had been fabricated. And I asked Marette, I said, Marette, how can you prove that? And she started sending me photograph after photograph, one of Tamerlan lying with his cat. And the point she was making, Gary, is Tamerlan had a beard. But in this footage, he's shown clean shaven. She sent me a link to a gymnasium where Tamerlan and Zocher were working out. Tamerlan had a beard. A friend of Tamerlan called him after the bombing, relieved to learn he'd been nowhere in the vicinity. They had dinner together that night. Tamerlan had a beard. If you look at the very next slide, number 15, you see this is Tamerlan being arrested. And while they fuzzied it up, there are others where you can see that in his arrest photograph, he has a beard. And here you have on the right, the death photograph. And look, Gary, notice his face. He's still got a beard. Now, what's stunning about this, Gary, and this is a very important point that most Americans haven't figured out, even though it's no more complicated than 2 + 2. Tamerlan was arrested by the police. They stripped him naked. They put him into a vehicle. And in other footage that isn't as blurred as this particular image, you can identify him. I could identify him, but he was identified by his mother and his aunt. yet he turns up dead subsequently, and the claim is made he was killed by Zucker driving over him repeatedly in an SUV. But, Gary, that was after he was taken into custody by the police.
He was already arrested.
How could his brother have killed him after he was taken into custody by the police, Gary?
My God, I mean, just to roll over him back and forth. And to be in police custody, that's almost like Oswald. You know, after you're in police custody, you're supposed to be protected. And then comes the law, then comes justice. But here, it's just amazing. And no one is prosecuted for this. And I wonder how much of this is true. I really have to wonder.
And Gary, we have a witness who said she watched the police drive over him three times in the SUV, which appears to be his own vehicle.
I mean, so he couldn't talk? Isn't there video of these guys saying, stop shooting, stop shooting? You know,
Yes. In relation to the arrest in Watertown and so forth, yes.
Right, and was also spotted by a crisis actress. There's a crisis actress who was at the Boston Marathon, was Adam Lanza's best friend, was in Watertown and witnessing the arrest of these two boys, the same woman, and is also a talking head on CNN. So this crisis woman gets around. And she
Gary. She gets around and she's probably well paid too. I'll bet she has transportation and accommodations covered as well.
I'm sure everyone's living pretty well that's going to participate in this evil. I mean, that's what pays. I mean, lies and deceit pay, and truth and honesty does not.
The next slide pretty much sums up the situation we confront here. According to the FBI and its media, suspect number one was killed by the police. Number two was on the loose until he was apprehended. But these guys aren't suspects, even though they're wearing the black nylon backpacks, and Zucker and Tamerlan are not, Gary. I mean, how bad is this?
It's just hard to imagine. I just hardly can believe it. But I just believe that when it came to the court and the trial, I just believe those were just manufactured stories, to where almost like the Trayvon Martin, believe it or not, I've looked into that, and that was a completely manufactured story from beginning to end, as long as it ran as well.
Well, and we're getting into the courthouse because it's outrageous. I mean, here we have, look at the next slide, number 17. John Remington Graham, remember, observed that since the backpacks don't match, there wasn't even probable cause for an arrest, much less an indictment or a conviction. In fact, that the backpacks don't match would have been the obvious mode of exoneration, proof that he was innocent of the crime. And yet, here you have his attorney, Judy Clark, in her opening statement declaring that he was guilty. Gary, you may or may not be aware, but some of Zucker's friends went to his arraignment, and they said it wasn't Zucker, that he had a deep guttural Russian accent, which Zucker did not have. They felt it was someone other than the man it was supposed to be.
Well, that might explain these cartoons we have here. What's a cartoon? We watch O.J. Simpson for, 9, 10 months or something like that?
I think weeks, Gary, but yeah, the fact of the matter is, right, why are they using drawings rather than actual photographs unless they're worried that someone would put two and two together, do a facial comparison, and conclude that this isn't the guy he's supposed to be?
Yeah, from this point on, I believe it's just completely fake. The friend said it's not him. God only knows what happened to the boy. But then from then on out, we don't really see anything, if I'm not mistaken. It's all news stories and drawings and things like that. This is the part of the case where I didn't follow quite as heavily.
Sure,
I knew it was
sure. Yeah. But the next slide's a very revealing one because they were manufacturing evidence. Now, this is Zucker, and what you see on the right is the confession he is alleged to have written on the inside of a boat when he was hiding from the police. Now, let me tell you something about this, Gary. The boat has a curved surface and is made out of fiberglass. Now, look at the lines there. Those are perfectly evenly spaced. Do you imagine anyone could write lines like that on the curved surface of a boat? And this is even more stunning. It requires a special writing implement to write on fiberglass. Does anyone think that Zucker just had to have one of those special writing implements with him when he was fleeing the police here?
That was the most bizarre thing. When you had every police agency from everywhere looking for these few little boys, and this little boy's in a boat, and then they just sprayed the boat with bullets, and he didn't die. The whole thing is just strange to me. And to where they would have to worry about, I mean, in New Orleans, they arrest 16-year-olds running across the street all the time. You know? So they needed the Army, the Navy, Air Force, Marines, all this equipment, the bulletproof vest, the machine guns to get this little boy.
Well, I have a whole chapter in the book about Zucker's bloody confession and why it's preposterous to suggest he would have been able to write out this confession on the inside of a boat. I mean, it's just ridiculous beyond belief, Gary. And look at the next slide. This is our key player. This is Judy Clark, where she has represented other prominent suspects in terrorist attacks like Ted Kaczynski. And she negotiated a plea deal. So in this case, she made sure the jury understood that Zucker was guilty by announcing in her opening statement, they did it. She's violating the rules, however, that are incumbent upon attorneys, which state, this is Rule 5200, trial conduct, in presenting a matter to a tribunal a member shall employ for the purpose of maintaining the cause, the cause confided to the member, which means only or consistent with truth. She's supposed to be acting in accordance with truth, that she shall not seek to mislead the judge, a judicial officer, or jury by an artifice or false statement of fact or law. But when she said they did it already, she was stating something that was false and misleading. Shall not intentionally misquote to a tribunal the language of a book, statute, or decision, shall not, knowing its invalidity, cite as authority a decision that has been overruled or a statute that's been repealed or declared unconstitutional, and shall not assert personal knowledge of the facts at issue except when testifying as a witness. She threw the case, Gary. There was a mountain of evidence. She could have brought in the video footage where you can hear the police on bullhorns calling out, this is a drill. This is a drill. She could have brought in the tweets from the Boston Globe. She could have been brought in photographs of these persons' missing limbs beneath the smoke with no blood. She could have brought in and shown this was fake Hollywood blood, that it came out of a tube. She could have even shown that the smoke came from a smoke machine. Gary, this is as embarrassing as it gets. She has betrayed her obligations as an attorney. And believe it or not, I complained to the California bar because she's licensed to practice in California. Not once, but two or even three times, I sent them all the evidence we have here, minus the smoke machine, of which I was unaware at the time. And they wrote back and said that they didn't see any cause to question the matter.
That's like O'Hara Weisberg saying, no evidentiary value here in this film. Because Oswald's not hanging out the window. You know, it's just the same thing over and over. It's just a different time, different circumstances, but it's the same thing over and over. You know, we don't have any evidentiary value to what you're saying is what this is. And,
here's the final slide for our discussion today. They had a friend in Florida who was worried. The FBI wanted to question him about the Boston bombing. He thought they were coming to kill him. Five officers question him, five agents, Gary. Typically, they do it in pairs where one agent asks the questions and the other takes notes. In this case, four of them left after determining that he was going to be unwavering in his declaration that the brothers hadn't done it. And the other claimed he became violent and shot him to death. So he's no longer available for questioning.
And that's got to be the most blatant example of murdering a witness that there's ever been.
It's grotesque. And he told friends they were coming to kill him. And by God, they did. They came and they killed him.
Oh, man.
And this, like is, what passes, this is what passes for justice in the United States today. The government insists the Boston bombing was a real deal, that all these people were several were killed and many injured, 260. I can't find 260 figures in any of these photographs. You put it all together, there might be 20 or 30 who are playing the key roles as crisis actors. These were amputee actors. We even have the crisis actor waiver form, Gary. This is a bloody shame and an embarrassment.
Yeah, all these stories are loaded with code, too. I see that 27 up there. That's 14. That's 27s right there. The whole thing is just lie on top of lie. And as I watch all this stuff, and I've been looking more into the numbers that they use, happens all the time. But
well, if we go back to the first slide, Chance, go back to the first slide. I'm just hopeful that the public will be open-minded enough to look at the evidence here. This book is like 440 pages. We must have at least 300 photographs. I mean, every aspect is documented. We have simply superb contributors. We got Sheila Casey, Sterling Harwood, J.D., Ph.D., Dr. Eowyn, Ph.D., Nick Kohlerstrom, Ph.D., James F. Tracy, Ph.D., Mike Palachek, Alan William Powell, John W. Whitehead, J.D., Craig McGee, Ole Domegaard, Jim Fetzer, Ph.D., Paul Craig Roberts, Ph.D. I mean, there's some heavy hitters there, Gary, and I hope that the public will take this opportunity to become informed about another scam. It is, as you've been observing, the most amateurish of them all, and I would like to believe that those who understand what happened in Boston will then have enough courage, integrity, and determination to go back and take another look at Sandy Hook if they were temporarily emotional and traumatized by the story there, which was designed to instill fear into the population, especially in the case of Sandy Hook, Gary, parents, terrorized parents by claiming to have killed 20 children. In the case of the Boston bombing, they were also trying to demonize Muslims. They were using this to subvert the Fourth Amendment in Boston because they conducted all kinds of unreasonable search and seizure. They brought a massive military presence into the city to lock it down in search of a single 19-year-old college student who had nothing to do with the crime. And at Sandy Hook, a month and 2 days later, Barack Obama signed no less than 23 executive orders to undermine our rights under the Second Amendment and introduce new mental health programs for elementary school kids. No one in the world has ever before that elementary school kids needed a mental health agenda, but it's going to create a new billion-dollar industry, Gary. It's pathetic. It's unbelievable. But it's the action by our president of the United States.
If they can get a child on prescriptions at 3 months, they will do it.
And bear in mind, the classic definition of an act of terrorism is to commit an act of violence to instill fear into a population to make it more amenable to manipulation in support of a political agenda. They discovered after 9/11 that faking it worked better than actually killing people, because then you can have lawsuits, you can have people wandering off the reservation, making all kinds of statements. If you have all of them under contract, you can keep everyone on the same script with the same message. So these were feigned acts of terrorism, but they were still acts of terrorism intended to instill fear into the American people to make us more amenable to political manipulation by the Obama administration, which means that the Obama administration has been practicing terrorism on the American people.
On a weekly basis, it seemed like there was a time where we'd go a few months between them. But if they need an agenda passed, and I'll give you an example in New Orleans, they want to take down all of the Confederate monuments. Why? Because of the Charleston shooting. Well, to get everyone racially divided in New Orleans, they didn't have to wait for some person, which could take 30 years, you know, for some random person just to go in and mow down an entire church full of black people. They don't have to wait for that. They just
They didn't have to wait because that was contrived too. We have photographs of Dylan Roof with no patches. They photoshopped on those apartheid patches onto his jacket. We have video of him entering the church at 0800. Someone didn't understand a 24-hour clock. They thought that meant 8 o'clock in the evening when it meant 8 o'clock in the morning. He supposedly shot up the church, which would have butchered a whole bunch of pews. There would have been wood, blood. The altar would have been a total mess. And yet 48 hours later, they had a perfectly ordinary church service. Hillary Clinton just happened to be in town, Gary. So she was able to send her personal photographer over to the church to take photographs that no doubt are going to show up in her campaign in the future.
And so was Jeb Bush.
Open casket funeral for Clementa Pinckney, who was a celebrated minister of the church, only it looked nothing like Clementa Pinckney. He was much too stocky. He had a very thick neck, a very dark skin. He appeared to be of Haitian origin, whereas Clementa Pinckney was an African American. I'm sorry to say, Gary, but my research into Charleston suggests it too was another fake event. In that case, to instill terror, fear into the hearts of every black American.
Well, in New Orleans, the number one topic right now is should we or should we not remove the Confederate monuments? All over a completely fake news story, and that's all it takes, and they can get the ball rolling. But the fact is there is more racial division in New Orleans now because of the monuments. You see, so they just don't have to wait, and it's on a daily basis now. And I began to start looking into Gabby Gifford, and that one is appearing to be a huge hoax as well. Have you looked into that?
Yeah, I have to a degree, and it is very suspicious in many ways. For example, when she's being taken out, there's no blood on the gurney. I mean, you know, she's supposed to have had a head wound that would bleed copiously. There even seem to be differences in the appearance of the Gabby Gifford now from the Gabby Gifford before. There are a whole lot of serious questions there. But for today, Gary, I want to thank you for participating in my discussion of this new book, And Nobody Died in Boston Either, available from Moon Rock Books. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking Gary King for joining me during the first segment. Stand by for the new JFK show, where we'll be joined by Larry Rivera and Don Fox. We'll be right back.
Moon Rock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moon Rock Books.
Less than 3% of you people read books, because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on Network Radio.
So turn off your television sets, turn them off now, turn them off and leave them off.
can now say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center. Center.
This is Jim Fetzer.
I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Gary King. This is a JFK segment. You take it away.
All right. Welcome to the new JFK show, number 91. This is round two, where Jim Fetzer's been attacked, and our guys step up, and we're going to pound the hell out of Jim DiEugenio tonight. Now, well, like Dr. Fetzer said, there is a fraud amongst us.
That would make sense if DiEugenio's wrong. We're going to take a look at the evidence to see if there's any possibility he might be right. Here we have in the first slide, of course, a reminder of his target, yours truly, and some of my work, which is available on Amazon.com. And what we're doing is the second part installment of our response to part one of his attack on me, seen in slide number two. Namely, The Decline and Fall of Jim Fetzer, Part 1, by James DiEugenio, where we covered the first, I think it may have been 10 or 11 of the objections that Don Fox had been able to ferret out of his attack. And now we'll continue with the rest for Part 1, and then next week we'll return for Part 2. Now, the next slide, number 3, shows the issue with which we're going to begin. So I guess we covered 5 out of what'll be maybe altogether 11 or 12 about the Zapruder film and my obsession with the idea that the film had been altered, not by a little, but by a lot. Before we begin, however, to even read his complaint, why don't we take a look at the Zapruder film? This is the best available version. You can find it, for example, on assassinationscience.com. It was constructed by John P. Costella, Ph.D. He took the best versions and improved them. Even the MPI version had slides missing and slides out of order. He corrected the order. He replaced the missing slides. He also removed two kinds of distortion, pincushion and aspect ratio distortion. So we're going to take a look at the film, which, of course, only runs 26 seconds. Oh. Okay, wonderful, wonderful. So the film is already playing. Now, is Don going to be joining us, Gary, Larry, do we know?
I just wanted to mention that John Costello's film is the Z film as we know it today, with the missing frames that we have already proven by Roy Schaefer's blink rate that have never ever been included in the film. So John Costello's film is the version as we know it today.
Well, of course, absolutely. And when I talked about missing frames, I meant from those so-called splices.
Right,
and
right.
As you watch the film, notice the huge gap between the motorcade as it starts to turn onto Elm Street, and then all of a sudden there's an enormous jump, and it's beside the Stemmons Freeway sign. I estimate there are at least 100 frames missing there. Abraham Zapruder, of course, reported that he had filmed continuously from the moment that the motorcade came into view on Houston turning onto Elm. So obviously, no one could argue that there haven't been massive edits, because you got over 100 frames that are missing right there, assuming it was shot at 18.3 frames per second. There's a huge gap there. But what we're going to get into is a whole lot of other stuff, because that huge gap, and then the two splices that had been made while it was in the possession of Life magazine, where John has been able to restore the missing frames, are not at issue when we talk about whether the film has been massively altered and edited. Now, Larry, would you or Gary like to read this first complaint coming from Jim DiEugenio?
Sure, I'll do that. Our point number six, the Z film, a growing obsession of Professor Fetzer's, namely that the film, as a Zapruder film, had been altered, and not by a little, but by a lot. Fetzer's argument is for wholesale alteration of the film. In fact, it was this strong belief by the former professor that led to a bitter personal feud with author and private investigator Josiah Tink Thompson. Thompson was allowed to have extensive access to the Zapruder film for the simple reason that Life owned it. He consequently examined individual frames with a magnifying glass, allowed to view transparencies and so on. No author at that time had anywhere near his exposure to the film. As a result, 6 Seconds in Dallas was written something like a visual essay using drawings made from the film. It is probably not too broad a statement to say that. Without his access to the film, Thompson's book would not exist, at least in the form it does today. It is therefore not unfair to claim that Thompson had a vested interest in the film being genuine.
Let me just comment on that. Yes, of course. When I returned from the Far East, where I'd been anchored out in Kaohsiung Harbor aboard the LPH Iwo Jima, which is a relatively flat bottom landing helicopter platform, because helicopters take off vertically. They don't need a long, stable runway like fixed-wing aircraft. Among the very first books I read on JFK was 6 Seconds in Dallas by Josiah Thompson, because he was a professor of philosophy. He'd been in the UDT. Because I was in the Marine Corps and studied philosophy, I would eventually, you know, resign my commission as a captain to enter graduate school, earn a PhD in the history and the philosophy of science, and begin a 35-year career as a college professor. I felt a great affinity with Josiah Thompson. And when we had this falling out, it really came as quite a surprise. It was unexpected to me, because I thought that he would show a greater dedication to truth. In fact, he became one of the foremost critics of all of the scientific work. Remember, even Vincent Bugliosi referred to my three books as the only exclusively scientific books ever published on the assassination. And while Josiah's background was not in analytical philosophy or scientifically oriented philosophy, rather in figures like Kierkegaard, existentialists who are far removed from a scientific approach, I was nevertheless taken aback when he began attacking assassination science, referring to it as assassinated science and seeking to debunk all of the important work, which we've already reviewed. Let's go to the next slide, Larry, and you can continue the attack from Jim DiEugenio. Slide four, Chance.
Since Fetzer did not edit his first anthology until 1998, he had no such vested interests. In fact, as we shall see, Fetzer seemed to enjoy challenging established Schibelhoff in the JFK case. As we shall also see in other fields, he seemed to actually revel in the combined role of trailblazer slash hellraiser. Hence, the feud between Fetzer and Thompson took on not just an inherent generational aspect, that is, between the established entity and the new kid on the block, it was also a debate over style and the way evidence was weighed and measured. Thompson represented a more conservative, considered traditional approach. Fetzer, who seemed to be radicalized and energized by his feud with Thompson, now seemed intent on picking up on almost any offbeat novelty in the field to further his self-styled role as the brave, bold, brass-balled iconoclast.
Well, of course, he's using a lot of emotive language there. He's giving a lot of spins. So I'm supposed to be radicalized. I'm supposed to be self-styled. I'm supposed to be an iconoclast. The fact of the matter is...
Hey, don't forget brass balls.
The fact of the matter is, having taught logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, having a background in scientific reasoning, having published extensively on scientific reasoning already... My approach was inevitably going to be different over someone who is less evidence-based, where, you know, I mean, I spent all these years teaching students how to avoid fallacies, and it was dumbfounding to me to find so many were being committed by figures who were highly respected in the field, such as Josiah Thompson and subsequently Robert Rodin. Let's take a look at the next slide, five, which illustrates part of the problem. You'll recall I talked about how in Murder in Dealey Plaza, slide five, Chance.
Yeah.
I talked about how in Murder in Dealey Plaza, Josiah Thompson wanted to praise Gary Aguilar's work while wanting to diminish the rest. But Gary Aguilar's work showed that there's something wrong with the film because it established through Bethesda, although I think it's flawed by not recognizing what we would learn from Doug Horn about James Humes having taken a cranial saw to the skull of JFK to enlarge in the wound to make it more look more like something that might have been caused by a shot from behind, and does not address the remarkable contraction of the wound into a tiny entry wound at the top of the skull by the HSCA. Nevertheless, we can see here already in frame 317 that we do not see that blowout at the back of the head. So that as soon as Josiah Thompson started praising Aguilar for his wonderful work, I observed that if Aguilar were right about the wound, then Thompson was wrong about the film because you can't see it. If you look at the next slide, number six, here are repeated descriptions across the top of the wound that Gary Aguilar was arguing was also seen in Bethesda, which was true up to a point. And where below you see David Mandick's study of the lateral cranial x-ray, that is of JFK's head from the side, where in the center image you see his definition of the area that had been patched by using a material much too dense to be human bone, or by a massive exposure of light to have similar effects. But whereas you will see in the next slide, it had occurred to me that they had spent so much time concealing the blacking out the wound in early frames, 314, 15, 16, 17, and so forth, they might have overlooked that it could be visible in later frames. And I discovered that in frame 374, you can actually see the blowout to the back of the head. So if we go in more closely here in the next frame, you'll see how clearly it's visible. The pinkish extension, by the way, is the bone flap. When you look at the diagrams of the HSCA, they diagram the bone flap out to the right side of the head. But the blowout at the back of the head is the grayish area there in the back. We remember how often bone brain matter is referred to as gray matter, and it does have a bluish gray cast. Chance, if you could go back two slides just ever so briefly, I want to complete. Yeah, look at the lower image there, Mantic's definition of the area, and then on the right in 374, and notice what a close proximity it is, where, of course, Chuck Crenshaw would emphasize that it was the size of your fist when you double it up. Now go forward to slide number 9, Gary, Chance. Here you see a contrast then between, you know, how the wound was blacked out in these early frames, and yet it's so conspicuous in frame 374 on the right. And I must say that, you know, a group of Hollywood film restoration experts have been working on this. They have an excellent, high-quality version obtained from the National Archives. I have seen it. It's astonishing in its clarity. And they were both blown away. They were all blown away by how crudely this blacking out of the back of the head had been done. I've not heard them observe the contrast between frames like 374 and earlier frames, but it exists. And where you, Larry, and others discovered yet another proof of the blowout in the back of the head. And if we look at slide number 10, because Jackie's white glove,
frame 343,
serves as a background for viewing the blowout. Would you like to talk about these couple of frames, Larry?
Yeah, this was actually a little more than a year ago that you and I published on this in Veterans Today regarding frame 343, and I just happened to have been watching a film on the JFK assassination, which contained this very clear rendition of the Zapruder film, only these few frames, and I noticed right away that the blowout was so incredibly clear on this that I took scans of that film and started to work with them. And if you can put the...
Yeah, go to the next slide, please. Yeah, the next. Number 11.
You know, I started to show, you know, which was her left hand and the right hand. And then the next slide, which I started
number
to...
Number 12, please.
Yeah. Yeah, because I wanted to establish where her hands were, you know, in this. And then, you know, I traced around where his head would have been, and the magnitude of the blowout was just incredible here. I mean, they didn't even try to hide this one. Apparently, this frame escaped their scrutiny, and whenever they manipulated this at the Hawkeye Works in Rochester. But I just wanted to backtrack a little bit because he mentioned that Tink Thompson had exclusive access to the film, and I just happened to know that there was a researcher by the name of Thomas Stamm who wrote the first treatise on the Z film, because he had he was one of the very first authors to have access to the film at the in slides at the National Archives, and back in 1965-1966, I think even before Josiah Thompson. And I mention this because this treatise has been quoted and had been referenced by many of the early researchers. In fact, John Kellen, who wrote a very good book on the early critics of the Warren Commission report, by the name the book is a very very good book. The name of the book is "Praise from a Future Generation," and he has a chapter dedicated to the Zapruder film, and he gives Thomas Stamm credit for being the very first researcher to have viewed the film at the National Archives and written this incredible report, which was devastating to the official version, the government version of the assassination. And like I said, it was used for many, many years and quoted extensively, and it's a report that's very rare. I've never been able to get my hands on it, but it was the very first extensive report on what was contained in the Zapruder film. So,
well, it's so very interesting you mentioned that. Go on to frame 13, if you will, Chance. because, you know, Jim DiEugenio wants to promote Tink Thompson as the end-all and the be-all as an authority on the film. But Josiah has always argued that the chronology, the chain of possession, made it impossible, overlooking the fact that the Secret Service was in on it. The fact that Secret Service had possession enabled them to transport it to the secret CIA film lab Hawkeye Works in Rochester. I mean, his chronology is just absurd. I was pointing out all the indications the film had been altered, which made the argument that it couldn't have been altered ridiculous on its face, because if it has been altered, obviously it could have been altered. But, you know, people like DiEugenio want to promote Thompson as though he were an authority, regardless of the evidence, Gary, regardless of the evidence. And here you see now, again, how Jackie's glove just serves as a perfect background to illustrate the depth of the wound, that missing portion of the skull on JFK's head.
This one's a classic, Jim. I don't see how anybody can. In fact, I posted this on a forum called JFK Assassination Net by Greg Burnham, and those people over there were totally flabbergasted when they saw this, you know.
And is there an award for JFK research? I mean, this deserves an award right here.
Yeah, I agree. And Larry's actually been responsible for several historic discoveries. Let's go to slide number 14. I've been emphasizing from the beginning a multiplicity of lines of evidence that substantiate that the film was altered. Here are three. We have more than 60 witnesses who reported seeing the limo slow dramatically or come to a complete stop, where it slowed dramatically as it came to a complete stop, where those witnesses include all four of the motorcycle escort officers. C, what happened on Elm Street, the eyewitnesses speak, compiled by John P. Costella, Ph.D., which you can find in assassinationresearch.com, which is a journal for advanced study of the death of JFK that John Costella and I co-edit. Two, we know that for nearly 50 years, Clint Hill has described climbing on the trunk, pushing Jackie down, lying across their bodies, peering into the moon, observing a fist-sized blowout and giving a thumbs down, all before the limo had reached the triple underpass. See, for example, JFK, who's telling the truth, Clint Hill, or the Zapruder film. In fact, to my astonishment, there's a singular sentence in the Kennedy Detail, the book written about the Secret Service coverage of JFK. I can't call it protection. Coverage of JFK in Dallas that includes a sentence about Clint Hill peering into this bloody fist-sized hole in the back of JFK's head, as though the authors didn't realize that that blew apart the official account and the authenticity of the Zapruder film. Three, we know that the original 8mm already split film developed in Dallas was taken to the NPIC, that's the National Photographic Interpretation Center, on Saturday the 23rd, and that a substitute 16mm unsplit film developed in Rochester was taken there on Sunday the 24th, where two different teams worked on the different versions. See, U.S. government official JFK cover-up film fabrication, where I'm reporting some of the important findings of Douglas Horn, who, of course, was a senior analyst for military records on the Assassination Records Review Board. Slide number 15, three more lines of proof that the film has been massively edited. Four, we also know that a half a dozen or more have viewed another film, apparently of the original, including William Raymond, Rich De La Rosa, Gregory Burnham, and several others, where Rich De La Rosa's description of its content appears as an appendix to The Great Zapruder Film Hoax, 2003. And see my article, Did Zapruder Film the Zapruder Film? Which turns out to be false because no one actually filmed a film that had been edited and created in a laboratory. So nobody filmed the Zapruder film. The Zapruder film, as we have it today, was a concoction of fabrication. Number five, we have John Costello's precise visual tutorial about evidence internal to the film that explains how we can know that the film is a fabrication, where all of its frames had to be reshot to create the right sequence of ghost panels. See, the JFK assassination film hoax and introduction where John has given an informal discussion of his film as well. Six, we have Larry Rivera's analysis of the testimony of the four motorcycle escort officers and their supervisor, Stavis Ellis, whom Fred Newcomb interviewed in 1971, which has been presented in his two videos, The JFK Horseman and The JFK Horseman Part 2, which leaves no doubt about it and extends the duration of the limo stop because Larry, as you reconstruct, Officer Hargis, riding to the left rear, actually dismounted his bike, ran between the two limousines up to the grassy knoll. Officer Douglas Jackson motored up the grassy knoll until his bike fell down, then proceeded on foot. Five agents got out of the Secret Service limousine and surrounded the presidential limousine. One took a chunk of skull from a little boy and threw it in the back seat, whereas I initially thought the limo stop duration might only have been 6 or 8 seconds. I now find it impossible to reconcile all these events with a stop less than 20 or 30 seconds in duration. Your comments?
Yeah. I wanted to add to that that even motorcycle escort Douglas Jackson clearly states in the Newcomb tapes that he says, talking about the Z film, that film has been cut up. It's been edited. I mean, you can't get any more specific than that, Jim, you know. And as you well mentioned, James Shaney stated that Bobby Hargis ran in between the two limos. But Bobby Hargis also, when asked about the motorcade and the limo, if it stopped, he stated that motorcade stopped 4 to 6 seconds. And then he added to that, and you won't read about that in the Warren Commission. I mean, that's pretty incredible right there, Jim. You know, I don't know how you can refute anything like that. These are men upon which these interviews were recorded back in 1971.
Not to put
and these are just to find a point on memory it. Because as you know, I was very, as you mentioned, I was very intimately involved in this project, and which took almost a year to complete, and then. And it reformulated the entire sequence of events there on Elm Street. So
here's a sample of some of the witnesses. If we look at slide number 16.
Yeah, slide just before 16. We go to the next slide, Jim. Before we go to the next slide, I just wanted to that of all we're on show number 91 now, and the JFK Horseman and the JFK Horseman 2 are our top viewed shows. Of all
of them. No, but apparently not by Jim DiEugenio and his colleagues. I mean, it's embarrassing that he does have no idea what he's talking about. Look at slide number 16, if we will. Chance. Here's some quotes. John's collation of eyewitness reports about the assassination includes dozens and dozens about the limo stop. Some reported seeing it slow dramatically and others that it came to a complete stop, which makes sense. From different positions, different witnesses would have seen it slow dramatically as it came to a complete stop. Among them is Tony Foster, who was interviewed by Deborah Conway in 2000. As Daniel Gallup has observed, Foster seems to have no idea that her recollections contradict the official record. Tony told Deborah, for some reason, the car stopped. It did stop for seconds. I don't even know why it stopped. And all of a sudden, it sped up and they went under the underpass. I could never figure out why the car stopped. The way she delivers these lines, Gallup observed, I doubt Tony had ever seen the extant Z film and had no idea her recollections contradicted that film. He said he was reminded of David Lifton's early 1971 interviews with the Newmans, who also said the limo had stopped. They have no way of knowing at the time that the Z film showed no such stop. All of this is to say the earliest recollections of individuals are likely to be the most significant, he added, especially if there's evidence of a lack of exposure to contrary viewpoints that might influence memory. For a few more, Billy Lovelady on the steps of the Texas School Depository, 19 March 1964. I recall that following the shooting, I ran toward the spot where President Kennedy's car had stopped, his FBI statement. Roy Truly on the north side of Elm Street in front of the building, 24 March 1964. The car, I saw the president's car swerve to the left and stop somewhere down in this area. Later, Mr. Bellin, when you saw the president's car seem to stop, how long did it appear to stop? Mr. Truly, it would be hard to say over a second or two something like that. I didn't see. I just saw it stop. I don't know. I didn't see it start up. Warren Commission testimony. Mrs. Earl Cabell. This is the wife of the mayor. Four cars behind the president's limousine at the top of Elm Street at the time of the shots, 13 July 1964. I was aware that the motorcade stopped dead still. There was no question about that. Later, as I told you, the motorcade was stopped later. Mr. Hubert, that was when your car at least had come to a standstill? Mrs. Cabell, every car in the motorcade had come to a standstill. Later, we were dead still for a matter of some seconds. Warren Commission testimony. If we go to slide number 17, here we have Clint Hill actually giving a talk at a bookstore in Warwick's in San Diego, as I recall, where he talked about rushing forward, pushing Jackie back, laying across their bodies, peering down in that fist-sized hole. John Costello realized how important this was, and I subsequently published an article about it entitled Who's Telling the Truth? Clint Hill or the Zapruder Film, which you can find online. Slide number 18 shows that while they made efforts to make the different films of the assassination come out the same way, there are significant differences between the Knicks and the Zapruder with regard to Jack and Jackie, because Jackie comes further back on the trunk and Clint Hill goes further forward than you see in the Zapruder film. So, you know, all this nonsense from Josiah Thompson about the Zapruder film being the closest thing we have to absolute truth about the assassination is simply complete poppycock. And if you look at slide 20, this was the best part.
Before you go to the next slide, I've been listening to a lot of these shills, and they all talk about how all these different home movies taken that day all show the same thing.
And well, John, it's great to have you here, but of course they don't.
I know, but that's the level where our criticism is coming from. A lot of people that does resonate with the public. I mean, a lot of people listen to these guys in the aggregate. You know, and
it's all very embarrassing. If you look at the next slide, by the way, the best part, the most scientific of Josiah Thompson's 6 seconds in Dallas was his double hit theory, where he observed that there's a motion forward between frames 312 and 313 and then back violently and to the left thereafter. Now, independently, David Lifton had consulted with Richard Feynman, Nobel Prize winning, one of the most brilliant physicists in the world, and Feynman had noticed the double hip theory, which Josiah Thompson has subsequently sought to take back. If you look at the next slide, number 20, you see a graph of where the head goes briefly forward and then back and to the left. When David Mandick and I discussed that violent back and to the left, we were in agreement that no witness had seen it. In fact, as I have described, and as those who have seen the uncut film has observed, Jack was hit in the back of the head. He slumped forward. Jackie eased him back up, was looking him right in the face when he was hit in the right temple by that frangible or exploding bullet that blew his brains out the back of his head with such force that when they impacted with Officer Hargis riding to the left rear, he initially thought he himself had been hit, and then Jack slumped to the left. What happened was that in editing, they took out too many frames, and they turned the slump to the left into a violent to the left and back that no one in Dealey Plaza observed in attempting to merge together the two wounds, so they wouldn't have to acknowledge that he'd been hit from at least two different directions already as evidence in the Z film.
Yeah, Dan Rather said his head went forward with considerable violence, though.
Well, that can't be quite right, because he slumped forward from being hit in the back of the head.
Yeah.
But Don, he did go forward.
He did, yeah.
It's been wrong that Dan Rather has been, you know, pilloried for that once the film was eventually released in 1975. When Robert Grote and Dick Gregory got it onto Geraldo Rivera's show. But the fact is...
I question the film that Dan Rather saw. I've always been suspicious that they had already made it appear that it was the way that Dan Rather described it. I think he saw a fake film.
Well, I'd be very surprised, Gary, given the history of this thing.
If memory serves, I thought Dan was talking about this on Friday night.
No, it was Saturday morning.
Was it Saturday morning? Okay, well, then he very well could have seen an early version of the fake film then.
No, Don, they had, Zapruder had the reporters come in to look at the film on Saturday morning. That's when he saw it. And he rushed off to report what he'd seen. But it looks as though he didn't quite pay enough attention. I mean, I think you can fault Dan Rather on many accounts, but I'm inclined to give him a bit of the benefit of the doubt here. What I won't give a benefit of the doubt to, however, is Jim DeEugenia or Josiah Thompson. I mean, look here. This is Josiah's own double hit theory, which Richard Feynman independently corroborated, which already proves conspiracy all by itself because he got one hit from behind and another from the right front. And yet in the final paragraph of the text of his book, Josiah says nothing in this book proves that there was a conspiracy in the death of JFK, which led no less a figure than Vincent Salandri to call him out on it and to identify Josiah as some kind of op.
That's right.
Let's go to the next. And Don, I'm so glad you're here. Let's look at slide 21 and you can read the next criticism.
Okay, so then point 7 here in our critique of Jim DeEugenio's critique, character assassination. There was a third character trait Fetzer exhibited that was not really suitable for the scholarly study of a complex phenomena like the JFK case, and that was an overweening self-righteousness. He was right no matter how much data there was against him, no matter how many people could show he was wrong, and no matter what their qualifications were. All these traits would come to the forefront in three instances that would soon surface on various forums dealing with the JFK assassination. Specifically, these were the cases of Judith Baker, Ralph Sinkay, and Peter Janney. By this time, not only was the professor online, he had his own internet podcast show called The Real Deal.
Well, let me begin by responding about this business about I not having a mind suitable for the scholarly study of complex phenomena. For God's sake, I published 24 scholarly books, including on the theoretical foundations of scientific knowledge, on the theoretical foundations of computer science, on the theoretical foundations of artificial intelligence, on the theoretical foundation of cognitive science and of evolution and mentality. Those are highly challenging, complex subjects that require a high degree of analytical ability and scientific background. This is a simply absurd complaint. And notice what he goes on to say, no matter how many people could show he was wrong and no matter what their qualifications. Now, he's talking about Josiah Thompson. He's talking about Robert Groden. These are the people who are supposed to have shown me I am wrong. But we've demonstrated that the situation is precisely the opposite. I mean, give me a break. This DeEugenio is so far off the reservation. He's not even responding even remotely to the realities of the situation or which of us has got it right. Look at the next slide, number 22. Robert Groden, one of those he greatly admires and esteems. Groden, here are 7 points about Groden. He denies the existence of a bullet hole in the windshield. He defends a set of autopsy photos that seem to be fabrications. He claims the Zapruder film is authentic, which may explain one, except it doesn't, as I'll explain. He maintains the Alton 6 photograph is also authentic, meaning it's not been altered or touched. He denies Oswald was in the doorway during the shooting, offers an alternative explanation of his location at the time, which also implies that Lee cannot have been on the 6th floor. So we're in agreement. Lee was not on the 6th floor and was not involved in the shooting, but his explanation and rationale appears to be unsustainable. Look at slide number 23. At the top, you see photographs that Groden has promoted as being authentic, but they're clearly fabrications. Look at all that gunk. Look at the length of the hair. It's a stunning contrast with the back of the head shown in the HSCA photograph. So notice that skull flap just above the ear on the left and just above the ear on the right, which was that pink extension I pointed out. Now, the HSCA clearly covered up the blowout at the back of the head. That is manifest. But it's also true that what Groden has at the top is preposterous. In fact, this led David Bannick and others to suggest to the Assassination Records Review Board, when they deposed Humes, they asked whether the subject had been given a shampoo and a haircut during the autopsy, which elicited from Humes a no, 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 no. But notice, I mean, this is ridiculous, simply grotesque for Grodin to claim that those photographs are authentic. But frame number 24.
Oh, Jim, before you go to that, those two bottom photos, if anybody's seen The Men Who Killed Kennedy, Tom Wilson subjected those photos to his machinery, and those look like painted images on a picture is really what that is. That's how they faked it.
Yeah, Tom did some brilliant work. Notice, by the way, on the right hand, you can see what's supposed to be the bullet hole, but that's painted in by Ida Dox. And on the left in the photograph, you don't see the bullet hole. This is further evidence of fabrication.
It's like the whole, like, from, especially like the bottom right photo there, basically almost from the ear to the middle of the head, all that was gone. Tom.
Yeah, Don, I know. But look, we got to get to number 24 to Grodin. Sure. We can come back to some of these issues. Look at slide number 24. Grodin claims there's no hole in the windshield. Well, look, you can see it right there. It's where JFK's left ear would be if his left ear were visible. It is in the Alton 6. Multiple witnesses, including police officers, reporting observing it at Parkland. One even stuck a pencil through it. As he explained in his chapter on the limo and murder in Dealey Plaza, 2000, Douglas Weldon, J.D., recently deceased, tracked down the official at Ford, had been responsible for replacing the windshield, who confirmed that the original had a throw-and-through hole. You can see it on the left. Now, they replaced it with a new windshield. Subsequently, the Secret Service would produce the image on the right, the kind of spider hole image that was supposed to be damaged from a fragment from inside to account for the problem. When I asked, you mentioned Gordon, Robin Unger, Larry, when I asked Robin to juxtapose those images to see whether they coincided, he refused to do it. Now look at the next slide, number 26. Here's what Grodin says. According to Grodin, the killing of a president, page 36, the photo taken by AP photographer James I. Alcon, technically known as the Alton 6, displays no signs of a bullet hole in the windshield, where he has a larger image that shows the spider web-like cracks. They, in agreement with the Secret Service, claim to have been caused by a fragment from a bullet fired from behind, not by a shot from in front. But even look here. I mean, this is a wide on his page, so I was unable to get both what he said in text and the image, but you can see the bullet hole right there in the windshield when he's denying it's there. And look at slide number 26, finally. If he claims the Zapruder film is authentic, well, it shows the bullet hole in frame 225. Mm-hmm. Research, which has been available since 2000, has been confirmed by more recent studies by Doug Horn, photographic evidence of bullet hole in JFK windshield for June 2012, and JFK conspiracy, the bullet hole in the windshield, 28 June 2012, and even more recently by Dennis Camino, tampering with a limo in the Alton 6, 20 March 2013. Indeed, as other students have observed, it can also be seen in Zapruder frame 225. I find Rodin's position here completely incoherent.
Jim, and I wanted to add briefly that subsequent to that, you, Gary, and I went down to Dealey Plaza and did some field work and actually traced that shot from under the overpass on Commerce and on the south side of Dealey Plaza.
That's right. That's right. And I think you're completely right that given the
following Weldon's work there.
That's right. We did an enhancement of Weldon's work because his location from which he believed the shot had been fired appears to be inaccurate, where the location we determined that you had sorted out, Larry, appears to be correct, that it was actually inside the triple underpass, facing the underpass on the left side, where there turns out to be a metal box, like a fuse box, where the rifle could have been conveniently stashed.
That's right. That's right.
After the shooting.
That's right. Right.
If anybody wants to see that, you go to On the Road with Dr. Fetzer, and it's toward the end of the video. They have about a 5-minute video where they demonstrate all that everyone's talking about right now.
Excellent. Go to slide 27, please, Jantz. Don, would you do the honors?
Absolutely. Okay, so here's point eight. Judy Baker. No matter how many people pointed out good reasons not to buy into Baker, Fetzer would not backtrack. And this is after he said that he would change his mind if confronted with contradictory information. Some pointed out his incredible stamina. Others, like myself, privately emailed him and advised him to desist since he was dealing with aspects of the case that he was not familiar with. Fetzer communicated back that he would do no such thing. This genuinely puzzled me since it defied his identity as a scholar. New Orleans is a very complex, multi-layered area of study in the JFK case. It literally takes years to understand it. Yet Fetzer, who had not done any real study of that area, was endorsing someone who made bizarre claims and had little backup for them. As many have stated about the JFK case, extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence, which Baker did not have. Yet that seemed all right with the professor. Her claims were enough.
Well, let me just point out three areas, for example, where I have changed my mind. I originally thought that Gregory Douglas' genocide was right on until I realized his report from the Russian Secret Service was the same scenario as the official government scenario. That was ridiculous, and I recognize it wasn't defensible. This happened within about 48-hour period. I even sought to arrange a lunch with Gregory Douglas in Chicago, but Gregory Douglas chose not to show up. So I changed my mind about regicide. I changed my mind about the role of the Mossad at Sandy Hook. When I first began research on Sandy Hook, I was given information by the senior editor at Sandy Hook, at Veterans Today, that there appeared to have been a three-man hit team, that they had made their escape in a white van back to Greenwich Village, where they went to a safe house loaded with Nazi paraphernalia. I wrote about that, taking for granted what he was telling me was true. Subsequent research led me to abandon that hypothesis as indefensible. No one appears to have died. The school was actually closed by 2008. So that's a second example where I changed my mind. A third is on Judy Wood and Dues. I featured Judy Wood 15 times on my radio shows, indeed the Real Deal audio show, where I had over some 880 shows. 15 times Judy Wood. She took me to, I was pioneering the use of radio combined with a computer, so we'd go to her website and we'd go through her evidence. I featured her for 3 hours at the Madison Conference on the science and politics of 9/11. I published a chapter by her in the 9/11 conspiracy, but I became convinced that she was wrong about it and that the evidence of a nuclear attack, including the U.S. Geological Survey evidence, which shows a whole host of elements that would only be present had this been a nuclear event, barium, strontium, lanthanum, lithium, tritium, and so forth, caused me to reject that hypothesis. Oh, it's a question of whether there's good evidence. I have never found good evidence to discount Judith Baker. And if you look at slide number 23, I even did early interviews with her. I have a channel of which most people are unaware called James Fetzer News. And you can find at least 10 or a dozen interviews I did with Judith Baker early on. I was already probing her research. I was seeking to assess it. And I became convinced that what she was telling me was true. I'm not the only one. Look at slide number 29, Dr. Mary's monkey. If you want someone who knows New Orleans inside and out, it's not Jim DiEugenio. It's Edward T. Haslam. And Haslam vetted Judith Baker's work. He followed the same trolley lines, the same locations where she had lived. He gave her a clean bill of health, just as had I. Judith has now published two books, the next slide, number 30, Me and Lee, which is abounds with evidence. And by the way, she had told me how she and a girlfriend had double dated when she was dating Lee and her girlfriend with her husband, where they went to a club in downtown New Orleans and met Carlos Marcello. And that girlfriend of Judith's confirmed that that was what had happened. There's all kinds of evidence here in her book. Perhaps Jim DiEugenio simply hasn't bothered to read it. And now in slide number 31, we see another major contribution from Judith Very Baker, a book about David Ferry. Because as she reports, under the supervision of Dr. Mary Sherman, she and David Ferry and Lee were conducting research to try to develop a rapid-acting cancer that could be used as a bioweapon, where they used to joke about Mary Sherman, Judith Very at the time, and David Ferry, which was in fact used as the name of an earlier book. But not only we have given her a good bill of health, look at number 32. Nigel Turner devoted all of episode 8 of The Men Who Killed Kennedy to the love affair with Judith Very Baker. I just don't understand how Jim DiEugenio can think that he has superior knowledge, how he can ply, "I've done no research," when I've done massive research. I was responsible for defending her in one of the longest threads in the history of the Education Forum, which wound up with, I don't know, some 6,000 different comments and exchanges. I mean, DiEugenio, once again, simply does not know what he is talking about. He has false idols. He's placed confident in Robert Grodin and in Josiah Thompson, whose work is provably indefensible, and indeed I've proven it here during this show this evening. Let's go to slide number 33, Don, and give us the next.
Jim, before we go on to that, I just wanted to mention that Ed Haslam's presentation last November at Judy Baker's conference was the highlight of the affair. And not only that, Judith's conference is starting to attract the very best JFK speakers, you know, and the list is just impressive. You know, right now I don't want to go through that list, but it must mean something, you know, that a lot of these JFK researchers are preferring to attend and to speak and to present their newest research at Judy's conference nowadays.
Yeah. Not only that, but 60 Minutes had done a thorough background check on Judith. They were prepared to run with the story when a decision was made at the highest level, undoubtedly political, that they could not do the show. So it was canceled at the last minute. DiEugenio would have you believe that's because her story wasn't credible, but it's the opposite. Her story was credible, and at the highest level, a political decision was made not to allow her story to be broadcast to the public because it was credible and undermined the impression the government had been working so hard to convey of Lee Oswald as a demented loose nut who would undertake a shooting of this kind for no discernible reason. Because Judith makes him a human being with real feelings, real emotions, a perfectly competent individual. And I'm convinced to this day that that's the reason why she has been so viciously attacked. Don, give us number 9.
Okay. Do you want to start the Alshans photo tonight, or do you want to hold off on that for next week, maybe?
Well, no, I want to do it. I want to do it now, Don.
Okay.
That's why I started early. I want to get through it.
Okay, all right, so here we go. Point 9, Alshans' photo. And a quote from DiEugenio. "I am not going to detail here what Fetzer and Ralphson K were propagating. It seemed to me so wild, so far out, that it was almost a caricature of what those so-called tinfoil hat JFK researchers were all about. So I refer the reader instead to their Oswald Innocence campaign homepage, in which they spell out what they mean. For those who don't care to wade through all those pages, in a nutshell, what they were saying was that in the famous Alshans photo, the facial features in the figure in the Texas school book depository doorway were done over in an attempt to hide its, i.e. Oswald's, identity. The object was to make it appear that it was Billy Lovelady. In other words, the photo was altered. As others pointed out, there were films from that day that showed Lovelady outside the book depository with a plaid shirt on, and another film inside the Dallas Police Department. That later film showed both Lovelady and Oswald in the same room at the same time. One can see that Lovelady had a shirt on that was similar to the figure in the doorway. Further, a central tenet of Fetzer and Sinkay was that the doorway man figure was wearing a V-neck undershirt. Yet when one looks at Robin Unger's finer resolution of the photo, to put it kindly, this is not readily evident.
Go to the next slide, 34, and continue.
Next slide.
Okay, and it later turned out that though the better photo renditions and comparisons, that the Fetzer Sinkay V-neck appeared to be an illusion from a chin shadow. This created a serious problem, since part of their argument was that Lovelady was wearing a round neck t-shirt and Oswald was not. For his version of the Ulchins, Fetzer had used a scan from Life magazine, which of course did not make for a very good rendition of the photo. Finally, Pat Spear pointed out that Oswald had changed his shirt after he had left the depository to go back to his rooming house. He did this since he did not think there was going to be any more work to do. Thus, the shirt that Fetzer claimed Oswald was wearing at the police station was not the same one he was wearing before the assassination. This in turn meant there was no control factor for the comparison, because we really do not know what shirt Oswald was wearing in the depository. And the Ulchins photo was a black and white picture, so it was not easy to be definite about its color and pattern.
I'd say this complaint is about the most irresponsible of all. He's taken segments. I never even heard of an argument that Lovelady was wearing a round neck t-shirt and Oswald was not. Lovelady was wearing a short sleeve, red and white, vertically striped shirt. And he confirmed that even to independent investigator from New York who flew all the Jones Harris all the way to talk to him about it, about the scans. We've taken the best scan that came from Grodin. Pat Spear pointing out he changed his shirt. That's ridiculous. The shirt he was wearing when he was arrested is so much like the shirt in the man in the doorway that the idea that he would have somehow gone home and changed his shirt into a shirt that was just like that of the man in the doorway is beyond ridiculous. Into absurd. Now look at frame number 35, slide number 35. And you'll see the area we're talking about here in the doorway, in the background. Many students of the assassination have inferred that that was in fact Lee Oswald in the doorway. But let's take a look at what I discovered when I learned that Lee had told Will Fritz during his interrogation that he was out with Bill Shelley in front. I began to do a search, and though we won't see the slide, everyone else will see the slide. This was from John McAdams' website, where you can see I have circled a man who had his face obfuscated in that area, which makes it impossible for anyone to deny that the photo has been altered because the man's face has been obfuscated. And there you see how cleverly John McAdams brought together images of this third figure who was wearing a red and black checkered shirt, who looks completely different than Doorman, to whom I have referred to as Gorilla Man, who's wearing a red and black checkered shirt that's buttoned right up to the top, where you can even see from this initial image that the Doorman shirt is splayed wide open. Go to slide number 37. This is a standard scan from Robert Grodin that is used here. Notice just above the black woman in the middle, you can see the face completely obfuscated. How can anyone deny the film has been, this photo has been messed with? Look at Lee Oswald. He's the doorman. He's missing his left shoulder. Black tie man is both behind him and in front of him at the same time. Unless doorman did not have a clavicle, a shoulder bone, that this is an anatomically impossible scenario. The man with his hands holding up above his head to protect his eyes from the sun has had his face obfuscated. Notice he's wearing a short sleeve shirt because we've been able to establish that was Billy Lovelady. Now go to slide number 38 and you'll see the similarity that makes such a difference. It was Ralph Sinkay who convinced me that it wasn't the face per se we should focus on, but rather the height, the weight, the build, the shirt, the t-shirt that were so significant. And if Jim Giugino is going to complain that Lee Oswald didn't have a V-neck, look at that photograph on the right. What could be more obvious? My understanding is he tugged his t-shirts, he pulled them and stretched them to make that. But this shirt and the shirt on Doorman are the key issues that Ralph Sinkay pointed out to me by virtue of his background as a chiropractor, which put him in a perfect position to make these observations. He was spot on. Look at slide number 39. Di Eugenio and others have repeated the absurdity that the FBI did not tell Billy Lovelady what shirt he should wear when they had him come in for an interview on 29 February 1963. But as it states right here, Lovelady advised us on the day of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, November 22, 1963, at the time of the assassination and shortly before, he was standing in the doorway of the front entrance to the Texas School Book Depository building, 411 Elm Street, Dallas, Texas, where he is employed. He stated he was wearing a red and white vertically striped shirt and blue jeans. And in fact, they took photographs. Here in slide number 40 are the photographs they took of Billy Lovelady. What is there to doubt about this? What is there to debate? The FBI's own report says they brought him in to show them the shirt he was wearing at the time, and it was a red and white vertically striped shirt, which also had short sleeves. I mean, this reaches the point of complete absurdity. And if you go to the next slide, number 41.
Looks like those slides are missing.
No, the chance is showing them. We discovered they were missing in the slide set, so I sent them to them separately so everyone can see them. And that's, I also sent you a slide set. In slide number 41, there's a comparison between the man in the checkered shirt in the foreground, to whom I have referred as Gorilla Man, and Billy Lovelady. They don't look at all the same. They have different build. Billy himself had said he was 2 to 3 inches shorter and 15 to 20 pounds heavier than Lee Oswald. He couldn't imagine why they would be confused. Then look at slide number 42, where we're now back to the slides for which we do have. The comparison of their left sleeves, and this is what the photographs taken by Robert Groden was done by Judith Very Baker, and look at slide number 43. Robert Groden was hired as a special consultant to the HSCA and came back and told them that the sleeve pattern on the Lovelady shirt, meaning the black and red checkered shirt, which he was not wearing at the time, was a closer match to Doorman's shirt than was Lee's shirt. But that's completely false. Look at the Lovelady shirt at the bottom right. It's totally different than Doorman. Look at Lee's shirt in the upper right. Very, very comparable. And look at the next. At the next slide, number 44, and you see how grossly derelict of anyone who maintains that this man in front was Billy Lovelady and that they were wearing the shirt. He doesn't even have a flap on his shirt. This is how corrupt has been Robert Groden's contribution to this issue. It's shocking to me.
And this is on page 187 of Groden's book, Killing of a President. These images are taken right from there, Jim.
And we have even more devastating proof, Larry, for which you are responsible. But as Don observed, we're running short. I hope by starting early we'd be able to finish. But this is a wonderful point for us to come back next week as we begin with part two of his critique of the rise and fall of Jim Fetzer, which I'm afraid is having a very different consequent and effect for those who know enough to understand whether what Di Eugenio is contending is true or false. We are reviewing the evidence here, which I believe leaves no doubt about it. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest. Gary, do you want to close it out?
All right, fellas, this has been round two, the new JFK show number 91. We really appreciate Larry Rivera, Don Fox, Jim Fetzer, myself, and most importantly, Chance George in the engineer's chair. We thank you again. We'll see you next week.